Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. This episode is inspired by a question I received from Mary, a pediatrician. She said, Dr. Amy, I see so many parents doing what they think is right, sleep training, and letting babies cry it out. I am now expecting my first child. I don't want to traumatize my child. What is the biology of trauma perspective on crying it out? In this episode, we're diving deep into how the nervous system is shaped in our earliest moments, months, and years of life, and what that means for you or for those that you help in regards to anxiety, depression, and relationship struggles later in life. I sat down with Dr. Darsha Narvaez, a renowned professor whose groundbreaking research on the evolved nest shows how early caregiving practices literally shape our neurobiology, and why this matters for healing trauma and building resilience throughout one's life. This episode is especially important for me if you know my story because of my own history of being a foster parent and adopting Miguel, and then starting a nonprofit where I work with other adoptive families trying to help their children love, trust, and accept them after their attachment trauma. In this episode, you will learn how common parenting practices can disrupt a baby's neurodevelopment, how the body's stress response develops in the first months of life, why early separations can lead to anxiety and depression later in life, and how childhood attachment impacts our adult health and relationships, and finally, simple ways that parents can repair connection and help their child's nervous system heal. So whether you're a parent, a practitioner, or a self-help individual on your own nervous system healing journey, welcome. This episode will give you insights into the human body and the impact of our early months and years of life. Mary, I will answer your question about the sleep training directly at the end of this episode. Let's get started. Welcome, Dr. Darsha. I so appreciate your time here. And as I've mentioned to you before, really appreciate the work that you do. And we are all very grateful for the way that your brain works, is able to hold all of these concepts and then actually get it out onto paper for us.
Well, great to be with you. Appreciate the opportunity to let my brain speak.
I really wanted you to come and share on this because you talk about this idea of a continuum of connection and how important that is and how often it gets disrupted. And then what are the physiological consequences of that disruption? So can we start there? And how would you describe a continuum of connection that is this nest that children really need to have?
Yes, we are social beings who are shaped all the time and constantly by our social experiences. Our biology is being enhanced or detracted from the social environments we're in, including in the womb. You want to have a very welcoming womb, right? The mother feeling calm a lot so that the biochemistry is growing the things that are supposed to be growing. And then the evolved nest that we talk about in our lab and study is about the kind of care and continuing that sense of connection, the sense of relationship, of companionship throughout life, actually. But it's especially important in the early years when our neurobiology and our body and brain is constructing itself. We're only born with 25% of adult brain volume at birth. That's full-term birth, 40 to 42 weeks. Most babies don't even get to stay in that long, right? And so there's a lot that happens very quickly. You know, every second things are growing. The baby's a different baby every moment. And so the kind of care the baby's receiving needs to be optimal to help everything grow in that way that allows them to unfold and become themselves and become a cooperative community member. And it's all reliant on connected, cooperative companionship from the generations around them.
What have we covered so far? Let's review. We've covered how trauma can start before birth. We've covered the supportive environment that babies need to feel safe. What's coming up next? What happens when babies are left to cry alone? When babies are first born, they actually don't know that they are separate from their moms. They think that they are still connected. And so
there are just common practices today that create that separation before their system, before their nervous system is ready for that separation. Tell us about that.
Right. Actually, the baby can get dysregulated very easily if they're not connected physically with caregiver, and they need to be re-regulated all the time. They're co-regulated by the caregivers. And if they're left alone too long or forced into isolation, you know, to sleep alone or left to cry, you're really ramping up dysregulation on all sorts of levels. And you don't really know what neurobiological structures are being shaped at that moment when you're leaving them in distress. And you may not know for years later when there'll be a gap in the brain, some we call lesion. And then that's the foundation that wasn't there. The brain compensates at first, right? But then over time, when the growth gets too heavy on top, let's say like a house, then that starts to creak and crack. And then you have these problems later in adolescence or even adulthood, you know, anxiety, depression, suicidality, the kinds of epidemics we're seeing in the United States.
You're saying that some of these epidemics that are showing up in adolescence with their mental health can actually be traced back to these very early life experiences.
Correct. Yes. And so what happens with that baby that's left to cry or left alone is they immediately go into a kind of a panic. Their survival systems gets triggered. It's panic, that's fear, that's rage. And if they don't get responded to, then their parasympathetic system, their rest digest system says, hey, you better stop using all that energy, or you're not going to live through this. So then they shut down. And then parents think, because they left them to cry and all they quieted down, oh, guess they're fine, right? No, but they're still in this, you know, state of not wellness. They're dissociating. They're not emotionally in their body anymore. Now you've left them with a sense of distrust. This is not a safe place to be. I'm going to shrink down to be the minimal self. And they carry a minimal self and a hole in their heart, right? Because when they're in distress, they don't know it's going to be over. They think they're in hell. It's an abyss. It's never ending. And so then people don't want to feel that again, right? Over time, they develop, addictions of various kinds to try to avoid feeling that abyss feeling. And so you end up with all these problematic behaviors that you picked up in order to feel better, right? Because you didn't have the tools within your body to feel better, you have to use a drug or something else.
That regulation has to happen at any cost.
That's right. Yeah. So you externally regulate somehow. It's supposed to be the parents, caregivers, the village of care all around you, of supportive care, who love you and welcome you. So the evolved nest is about a welcoming social climate. You're given breast milk on request for several years. You're calmed down. You're kept calm responsively with multiple adult caregivers. So this is not just mom and dad, right? It's a village. And you're allowed to play and you want to play and everybody's playing because that's building the right hemisphere and all sorts of self-control and self-regulation and empathy and higher consciousness. And then you're in the natural world. You're building nature connection because you're immersed with the animals and plants around you and rivers and mountains, wherever you are. And then because we always, throughout life, as human beings, get dysregulated, you have systems of re-regulation that are built into the society, the community. In the early life and babyhood, it's the parents that, you know, carrying you around all the time, or your grandparents or your friendly community members who are keeping you calm and keeping you, you know, moving and bouncing and, you know, attentive to you, carefully, not intruding on you. But as you age, you have peer groups, multiple age playmates. They're also co-regulating you with play, and you learn not to be too aggressive in play because your playmates will stop playing with you. And so you learn to control yourself and you learn how you grow the stuff that's very socially attuned. And that's our human heritage, is to be very socially attuned, to be communally oriented. But when you distress babies, you're setting them off on a different kind of trajectory. You're setting them on a trajectory of self-protection. Their brain isn't going to be so flexible. They're going to be more, you know, bracing, you know, this might be the moment I'm going to go into the abyss again. Oh, no. And so they get very self-protective in how they act, and your capacities are about that. and their imagination is about that. And we can see, I think, in the United States, a lot of people, adults now, who are in those states very easily. So you get easily pushed into that state. Somebody makes you afraid. Oh, no, the abyss is upon me, right? And so you do whatever you can to not feel that feeling. And a lot of times it's blaming that group. They're the ones making me upset. Let's get rid of them.
What I really want to highlight of what you're saying is that this abyss is a felt sensation in the body. Right. Yes, there are some thoughts that are associated with that, but it is a felt sensation in the body that comes from early life experiences before there were words. And it was that experience, that felt sensation of, I am all alone. There is no one here that is helping me with this intense emotional state. And babies are not born with that capacity to regulate themselves yet. And so if they don't have that degree, that enough of regulation, then they are left with this nervous system that is, it's like it's patterned to go into that abyss frequently because it becomes like a default highway that it just happens automatically because it happens so many times in early life, often without the parents knowing because they're just doing what they have been taught. Are some of the normal parenting practices you've mentioned around sleep being one of them.
That's right. Yes.
So explain to us the vagus nerve and the portions that are unmyelinated, myelinated, how that happens over neurodevelopment in early childhood that is playing a role in this felt experience that then becomes overwhelming to an infant or a child that they have to actually shut that off and disconnect from themselves in order to survive, actually.
Yeah, right. So the vagus nerve is the 10th cranial nerve. And it's called the vagus. That means wandering because it wanders through various systems. It comes from both sides of the brain and goes through all the major organs and innervates them. And a lot of them are in the gut. Martha Welch's work from Columbia has shown that the vagus nerve in the gut is what occurs when the mother and child connect and co-regulate. It's actually connecting and co-regulating there, right? And it's so vital for a young child because they're still growing their immune system, most of which is in the gut. And you want that vagus nerve to then grow optimally, right? With that, but you need someone's help to do that. Otherwise, it just doesn't do its job and it goes into a more primitive state. Instead of the more advanced state of connecting to others, which is the myelinated vagus, is able to do. And if you don't have that developed from your social experience in those early years, there's ways to fix it later, to heal it. If you don't have that, you're going to have trouble with intimacy, being close to people, with compassion. It's like it's linked to oxytocin, your cuddle hormone. It's linked to various ways of being social. So it's not just all your health systems, your lungs work or your gut, your digestion. It's also part of that connectedness that we were talking about earlier. It's a physiological thing that we are social, but also biological beings.
I think there's been this kind of misconception that your attachment style is really just your style in relationships. And, you know, let's give you a test and a quiz to see which attachment style you are. And here I am, you know, with the biology of trauma saying, no, like your attachment, your neurodevelopment is everything, everything. Your physical health, your emotional health, your mental health, but even down to your behaviors, your decisions, your coping mechanisms, the habits that you've developed, everything. You can trace back to the attachment and neurodevelopment because that is how your nervous system formed.
That's right. And it's, I have a hard time convincing people too, because the bias in scholarship and academia and universities and pretty much every department is we're humans in the head. You know, reason, that's what makes us special. To think, you know, and to cognize, to mentally imagine. And then, you know, you forget everything else right below the head. So my work has always been to pay attention. Your head is dependent on your body and your body is shaped by early experience. So attachment's not just the internal working model, you know, what you're thinking about. It's neurobiology. You're engraving your children, right? As a parent or a caregiver, or whoever you are with a baby, you're engraving their brain.
Let's do a quick review of what we've covered. We've just talked about how babies panic, then shut down when left alone for too long. We've also covered how early connection shapes our nervous system wiring. What's up next? How parents can pass their stress patterns to their kids and how to fix it.
So let's talk a little bit about that parental neurobiology and the parental nervous system and what is needed. Because I can imagine many parents and many moms, especially, like starting to have the guilt, right? And knowing that, hey, like when we had our children, we were doing the best that we could with what we had at the time. And our nervous system does get passed on to our children. Share around this idea that, you know, like moms have a certain capacity of their nervous system to be present, to be alive, to be resilient. And that affects their ability to be in relationship with their child.
Yes, parents pass on the way that they were treated as babies and young children to the way they treat their own children, unless they've had some healing in between, if they were poorly kind of dysregulated early on. If they haven't had any healing, then they're going to pass that on, right? So it's really important to understand that co-regulation is part of what you need as a parent too, right? So having that skin-to-skin contact early on in the hospital, if you're in the hospital giving birth, that's actually going to help co-regulate you as a mother as well as the child and connect you in those reward systems right after birth, in naturalistic settings anyway. Are they ready to magnetize? They're ready to be magnetically connecting you and the child. And then forever after, you know, you've got it. And so when you've missed that for whatever reason, there are new ways to then co-regulate at that visceral level. So Martha Welch has done various interventions with this and shows that if the mother is open-hearted and, you know, acknowledges her sadness, maybe that they're not connecting, the child will come and then they can hug. And it might take a few times to do this, but then they can just sit there and be physically together. And then they're co-regulated and the whole relationships kind of gets balanced out again. And sometimes you have to keep doing this, right? Especially if it's been dysregulated. But I also have recommended for adults who get easily uncalm, easily dysregulated, to learn all sorts of self-calming techniques. And the one I always use with my students was belly breathing, because that's an easy one to convey, to watch videos and learn, you know. But we also use folk song games and play, because that's another way, again, to co-regulate with each other, but also extend social joy and learn to let go in the moment with others.
Going back to just that moment of birth, I kind of put myself back in that place where a mom would normally naturally have those strong desires to connect with her child in that moment, because of her neurobiology, right? Like you say, everything in both of their bodies and brains, everything at that moment is intended to have that intense connection coming out of the uterus, coming out of the womb. And baby is, wow, had such a shock, and yet it still feels like it is connected to mom. And so having that skin to skin would be so natural. And if that did not happen, if that were not allowed to happen for whatever reason, what the mom must experience in her nervous system as well, that would cause dysregulation, because this is not natural. Like, this is not the way it should go. I need my child. I need that connection with my child.
Right. We have a lot of postpartum depression, and if mothers have to go back to work after 6 weeks because there's no paid parental leave, and if they're not breastfeeding at all because they have to go back to work soon and don't want to feel the pain of separation, of stopping breastfeeding, all that is undermining the co-regulation that's supposed to happen, right? So there are ways, though, if you have to go back to work, to come back home and have those moments of co-regulation, the visceral cuddling. My husband and I huggle. So it's hug and cuddling together, right? And getting that coordination and feeling back home and, you know,
you're grounded again.
And that's where exactly I wanted to ask you to go next, where this idea of disruptions happen, right? And in fact, they're intended to happen. And when disruptions happen, we have this amazing ability to repair and repair that connection, repair the attunement, repair the attachment, the regulation. And so this is also why I have loved Martha Welch's work around this, because she describes these beautiful processes and how to repair. And I don't know if we've had this conversation, Darsha, but back in 2011, I started Family Challenge Camps, where they were intensives for families. I was primarily working with families who at first had adopted, because that was my experience adopting my son. But then families started coming who recognized that their children had trust and attachment issues that were showing up in their behaviors and their emotional regulation or lack thereof, right? And what we found was that a high percentage of them, their children had been placed in the NICU right at birth. And so they had had that separation at a time when that attachment was so queued up to happen. And so it was very interesting to see the life experiences that just predictably, right? Like predictably cause these types of issues later on in life that parents can recognize. But coming back to Martha Welch's work, just around this idea that there's so much beauty in the repair that can happen. And rather than pushing our kids away and making them go away to try to regulate themselves, which is impossible for them to do with the nervous system that they have, actually bringing them in closer and being that stability for them, being that strength of nervous system and sharing our nervous system with them. And can you speak more on that concept of the repair that parents can do when there has been a disruption, or even as adults, right? Like you and your husband, what was the word that you used?
Huggle.
Yes. The power and repair and what that looks like and what's happening on a physiology level with that.
So let me just say that babies get dysregulated very easily. That's why our nest is that they're carried pretty much 24/7 until they want to start moving on their own. But they're always physically close because the baby is always otherwise, you know, starts to get uncomfortable, you know, and you have to pay attention to when they're starting to make a face. That's the first thing. And then they start to wiggle. And that's a long time before they cry. Crying is a late signal. And so it's really important for adults to recognize the signaling of the baby, their baby, and then get them back comforted again, right? And calm down with all sorts of different kinds of rocking, you know, that work.
Let me just jump in right there, because that right there, like you have described attunement, where a parent is so attuned with their child that they see those things. And one of the saddest things for me has been to see parents become so busy and so distracted that they don't notice those things until their child cries, not realizing that there have been signs and cues that they've been trying to give them. They're trying to make that connection with you. And when it doesn't land and you don't respond, that is actually a disruption. And one of the, I think, the harshest things that our society has done for infants and early children that is unintentional, and yet quite harmful.
Right. And the belief that, oh, children cry. No, they don't. Or babies cry, right? Don't worry. It's fine. They always do that. Well, not in our ancestral context. So we spent 99% of our history as a human species, a human genus, in nomadic foraging societies, small bands of 5-25 people usually. They're nomadically foraging, so they're very free. They don't have possessions. And they're carrying the baby all the time. Or letting
I'm going to say, they're carrying the baby. Their baby is physically connected and getting that regulation from them.
Right. And they can sense when you carry your child a lot, and some people have written about this, you can tell when they need to eliminate poop or pee, right? And so then you move them away from your body, right? But you learn to recognize the signals without having to hear anything, but you feel it, right? So that's our heritage, is to feel the needs of the children and feel the needs of the people around us without them having to say anything or cry or yell or whatever. So we've lost that in part because when we moved to agriculture and people had to go out in the fields, they left babies behind, you know, and they gave them less breast milk, less attention, less responsiveness. And we've gotten used to that for the last few thousand years. Worse now with industrialization and the way our society is set up. Yeah. So dysregulation then is something that we all experience every day, right? And so we need practices to get us back aligned. And of course, you could take drugs or something, but it's better to have the internalized endogenous opioids get revved up. And that's from cuddling, right? They're from just social joy with others. Your gut body built drugs, body inbuilt drugs that should be triggered rather than having to get something from the outside. And then, there's all sorts of problems with that, as we know.
Let me just jump in right there, because when I went into addiction medicine coming out of general surgery, I changed my career into attachment trauma and addictions. And so I've been working in addictions, and it was astounding to me how many people fell into becoming dependent on pain pills. They also kind of fell into becoming dependent on anxiety medications like the benzodiazepines, but then would get so dependent on them that their body would go through these horrible withdrawals when they tried to stop. And so they would have to come into my medical detox, and I would help detox them off of these substances. But it's not just the epidemic with the other opiates like heroin and some of these things. Though, again, given what you're describing about the internal regulation and the lack thereof and the absolute need that our system has to find something to bring down the intensity of that discomfort of the abyss. And so I'm not surprised at all at that epidemic, but also the pain pills. And I think that what many people have not understood is that their biology, their nervous system was going to respond in such a way to these exogenous opiates through the pain pills because it was meeting a need that the nervous system had pre-existing. Yes, those pills are addictive to begin with, but their nervous system was already struggling. And so responded in such a way to pain pills that was really meeting a need for regulation that they had not experienced. And numbing, right? Like you talk a lot about just not wanting to feel that uncomfortable sensation in the body of feeling alone, feeling lost. And so to be able to have that effect from the opiates where you don't feel that. People got surprised at how their system responded so strongly to pain pills.
Yeah, and there are early experiences in babyhood that lead you to be more sensitive to pain as well. And one of them is circumcision, which is a horrible, there are other ways to welcome a baby into a community other than circumcision, but it has lasting physiological and psychological effects. Not good ones. And then there are other painful procedures that are done to babies in the hospitals that when they were instituted when they didn't think babies felt any pain.
Exactly.
Right. And so then you've got this imprint of extreme pain, right? And the body is trying to compensate, right? And then uses habits, develops habits that are actually quite harmful.
Yes. Understanding that the nervous system is not yet developed enough in a baby to experience that level of shock and pain could inform us to move a lot of those things to later in life when their nervous system was more developed.
Mm-hmm. Or avoid them entirely.
Or avoid them entirely. Thank you, Darsha. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let's review what we've covered. Now you understand why we've lost our ability to feel children's needs before they cry. We've looked at the link between early pain and later addiction vulnerability. What's coming up next is what children actually need to thrive. One thing that I would love for you to mention is this idea around focusing on wellness, right? We have all these trauma-informed and even trauma-inducing modalities, but this focus on wellness, this focus on resilience, this focus on thriving. And what have we forgotten as a culture just about being alive and living? And let's focus on that. And then that allows us to move towards that and when we focus on the trauma, we're going to move towards that. And so really being able to say, no, like this is wellness. This is how we are defining wellness and resilience and thriving, and being able to look at what have we forgotten as a culture about being alive that you would like to introduce and bring into the conversation.
Yeah, we are really stuck at the moment in the trauma-inducing pathway, I call it. And I've been reading about the Puritans, and I think they may have something to do with it, because it's all about work, 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 and, you know, pain, 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 and no pleasure. And so anti, you know, being a human being almost, be robotic, be a worker. And so the trauma-inducing pathway is the one where you don't meet the basic needs of a child, the needs for companionship, for belonging, for competence development, for autonomy, for being able to make choices, for, you know, self-actualization. The baby really needs all of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They should all be provided to that baby at once, right? Because they're growing. They need love, esteem, security, but also to grow into their being, their uniqueness. And the trauma-informed pathway doesn't do that. And so you end up with neurobiologies that are less than optimal, and then adults who kind of turn into not very well, and they're not going to be very wise because their body's all dysregulated and oriented to just staying alive and surviving. And then they create a culture that keeps this cycle going, what I call a cycle of competitive detachment, because it's about, you know, parents against children. You know, you got to control your children or they will. You'll spoil the baby if you touch them, you know, whatever this crazy stuff is. Very dysregulated culture. The wellness-informed pathway, of course, is the opposite. It's providing for the basic needs through the evolved nest, all the practices we talk about. It builds a nice, healthy neurobiology and the ability to be relationally attuned to others, to actually be well and end up being wise because everything's working well. And then you create the culture that continues that cycle. And it's all also with a nature connection aspect. So the wellness involves being a member of the earth community and being a partner with the natural world instead of trying to dominate, control, exterminate, right? And so that's the other piece beyond the interpersonal neurobiology. It's also the earth-centric neurobiological kind of communal ecological attachment. I mean, we could add all sorts of words to that.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you talk about in your list of needs from early childhood is this ability to rest in the relationship and how different that is from our society that has become very competitive and performance and work focused. And you're right, like work and no play, right? Like there's no play until your work is done. Even early childhood has now become about educational stuff and how soon can you get your children to read, and you know, bringing in the educational games. And it's so much focused on this. And yet when, I mean, just thinking about being able to rest in a relationship, knowing that you belong, knowing that you exist, knowing that they delight in you, and there's no work that you need to do in order for them to delight in you. What a change that would be for the nervous system for our children. Darsha, thank you. Thank you for your time. But more importantly, again, like thank you for your work in the world. I know that you've had quite the background and the path to this work as well. And I want to appreciate all that you have been through to get to this place where you are able to share and assimilate all of this information for our benefit. And I hope that many, many more people come across your work and start to take it to heart, actually apply it, not just have it be head knowledge.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be with you. Wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for the work you're doing to help heal the world.
What an incredible conversation. Thank you, Darsha. I have put together a healing attachment trauma roadmap that gives you where to start and the path forward. I'll link to that in the show notes along with my book, The Biology of Trauma, that in chapter 11 goes deep into attachment and how it creates our pre-existing filter, a lens through which we see and experience all of life. Again, that is chapter 11 in my book, The Biology of Trauma. And when you are ready to actually start to open up the inner pain, regulate your nervous system, and address the biology of trauma that has been created from decades of holding on to attachment issues, you will want to take your foundational journey. This is also the foundational module for those practitioners who want to enter the certificate training program to become a biology of trauma professional. If you love this attachment stuff as much as I do, you will want to check out podcast episodes 14 and 92 with Betty Lamont and Dr. Tion Dayton, respectively. Betty Lamont spoke on the role of neurodevelopment on attachment, and Dr. Tion Dayton spoke on the effect of childhood chaos on our adult nervous system. If you want to hear directly from some of the adoptive families that I worked with and get the behind the scenes of what it is like to parent a child with significant attachment and trust issues, I will have a link to a video that I put together to share some of their experiences. This video could actually be really helpful to those of you who are adoptive parents and maybe are looking to understand your experience and see if your child might have signs of attachment trauma. Now, to answer your question, Mary, it is true that crying it out is not consistent with what we want to do once we understand the biology of trauma and how the body experiences overwhelm and its impact on our physiology and our biology. These babies will experience what Darsha calls the abyss, that overwhelming feeling of being completely alone in their distress. That is a trauma. And their developing nervous system will adapt with trauma-based survival strategies rather than healing and resilience-based strategies. Now, for those parents who practiced cry it out sleep training, this is not to have you feel guilty. We all do the best we can with what we have at that time in our life. No parent would intentionally hurt and harm their child. And we can repair attachment pain and trauma, and that is why I put together the Healing Attachment Trauma Roadmap. I am here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the healing journey. So please take a moment to leave a review. You can also ask your questions on the show notes, and your feedback is how I know how to improve this podcast, bring you great content, and help others find the information that could change their lives as well. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Until next episode, lots of love.